Just a note before we start. Our show talks about touchy subjects that may be difficult for some of our listeners. Take care of yourself. If you feel you need to seek help, see the links at the end of our show notes for resources.
Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Touchy Subjects Podcast, the podcast that aims to break the silence that tends to come with conversations around domestic and sexual violence. I'm Sean.
And I'm Amanda.
And today we're going to be discussing Title IX with friend of the podcast, Kara Tuttle Bell. So thank you for joining us again, Kara.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
We're excited to have you back.
So we have brought Kara back because she is kind of an expert when it comes to this topic. If I do say so, based on, you know, what you do for a living.
Thank you. I mean, that's fair. I've been doing it for a while and navigate what we're going to talk about today every day.
Yes. So really just jumping into the discussion, Kara, what is Title IX?
Okay. So Title IX is a federal law. It is a federal civil rights law. It is actually not a new law. I'm saying all of this because I hear these questions all the time where if people have, you know, perhaps seen it in the news in recent years, they're thinking that maybe it came out of nowhere when actually it goes all the way back to 1972. So it's actually got a long history. It was part of the Education Amendments, and it does touch on sexual harassment and sexual misconduct, as well as a variety of equity issues on campus. A lot of people were first familiar with Title IX in the way it was applied to athletics, but it actually says neither the word athletics nor sexual harassment or sexual assault in the original law. It really was focused on equity in educational opportunity when it was passed in the early 70s. And it makes sense historically, coming when it does as part of, although on a tail end, of the civil rights movement. So if you think of the many laws that were passed in the mid-60s, the late 60s, the early 70s, this actually makes a lot of sense as one of those. Now, given what it touches on, sometimes people are confused about whether it's a civil law or civil rights law or criminal law. It's not criminal in any capacity. It's really a civil rights law focused on equity.
Yeah, I think that distinction is really important for those listening, because when you think of, like, if it's a federal crime or a federal thing that's going to be involved, that there's going to be a much larger process, and that makes it's a little bit more scary for people.
Yes. It's become very scary for people, but I think it's because there are really provocative headlines, some really high stakes cases that come up under Title IX. But I like the law. I like the original purpose of the law. It really gives students rights and schools responsibilities. It's been expanded to give employees some rights that are really important, that are really crucial if we're doing, we being academic institutions, the work that we say we're doing around diversity and inclusion and belonging and fairness and justice, right? This is one of those tools. This is a federal law that was needed, is needed, has evolved over time, as laws do. And it's federal, so it's coming to us from the Department of Education onto all schools or institutions that receive federal funding. So there are some, there are a few, but there are some private institutions that receive no federal dollars, and then they would not be subject to the law that is Title IX. But nearly all academic institutions, and including some vocational and training schools and programs, and then all K-12 public schools would be subject to Title IX. And so it's really most schools, wherever you are, in countries and territories governed by, you know, by the United States.
I'm glad that you threw in the high school part, mm-hmm. just because it also often feels like when I'm having discussions with people around Title IX, like, that's the college thing.
Yes. Yes. I mean, K-12, now they are on notice. Now they should know by now, but they are late to the game. I'm not going to lie. Okay. So for many years, well, for many years, it would be fair to say the law was on the books, but enforcement was lacking. And I would not be alone in saying that. It was good intentions. We had occasional guidance, often coming in what's called dear colleague letters. So someone from the Department of Education would send out to relevant people in the administration a dear colleague letter, just letting them know that the guidance had changed. But it wasn't strictly enforced until really about 2014. Okay, so we had some initial eyes on you, like pay attention, got to make some changes in 2001. Another, no, really, we're serious letter in 2011. But this like increase in colleges and universities put under investigation starting around 2014. Now, all during this time, K through 12 is really just functioning kind of obliviously, really, for the most part. I'm sure there are great people out there who were keeping certain schools in check, but as a, like nationwide, this was not trending and compliance issues or conferences. It's like what you needed to know in the K through 12 environment. I didn't see this, you know, being the topic for professional associations really until the past few years. So colleges and universities certainly have had to adapt, embrace, learn, make changes over the past 10 years. And then K through 12, let's see, I mean, five at most is where I think they would be like, oh no, this applies to us too. We've got to put these things in writing. We've got to designate a Title IX coordinator. And then in 2020, they had some specific changes that they had to make. So that feels really new for them, even though if we're checking, which, you know, we are, the law applied to them for a long time. But as far as this being a federal government priority and then enforcement being sufficiently resourced and funded by the federal government, which then is what puts the pressure and scrutiny on the institutions to do things like update those policies and answer some really tough questions that they might have to answer, has been recent history.
Got it. Which is also just like, because even when I look up, like, because I work with high schools and middle schools all the time, it's, I still have a hard time even finding who their Title IX coordinator is at the school. So I can only imagine that if I was somebody at the school looking to try to figure out how to reach out to them, that that would be incredibly difficult.
Well, yes. And that's asking a lot of a junior high or high school student to understand what Title IX is. I mean, typically it is, like when I present on my campus, I'm always saying Title IX is both the name of an office and the name of the federal law, right? Because they're like getting confused about this. And then Title IX has got this negative connotation now, where people, well, the students are substituting it for sexual misconduct. And I'm trying to gently be like, well, Title IX, the law, doesn't necessarily need to have the negative connotations as one might think about the perpetration of sexual violence. Let's like talk about what the law has to offer. Now, you know, is everyone handling their compliance with the law smoothly? No, not necessarily. So I understand all the feelings around it, but I don't know. I mean, I am also concerned if you were the parent of a K through 12 student, if you are the parent of a minor, you're going to be very, very concerned about the types of things that are going to come up. And so I don't think there's any consistency yet in being able to find these resources if you need it. Does the school have a timeline coordinator? Does it need to be a standalone position? Or is it someone who has gotten this gift as other duties as assigned? For decades, the Title IX coordinator was housed in athletics. It was just another part of the compliance role. So if like the person had to ensure they were complying with the NCAA or any conference specifics, that person usually had the Title IX forms to send in. But then when we began applying this gender equity lens to things like pregnant students and sexual misconduct, well, that was outside the scope and the skill set really of that athletics-based Title IX coordinator. So there's been an evolution, and K through 12, as I was saying, they're early on it. So you're going to see some schools that know they have to have the name listed, contact information, and a policy, but you're still going to see many, many schools who don't have anything to find on the website, which is a shame. They need to catch up.
Yeah. And when we're specifically talking about the way that those K through 12 schools get set up in the first place, we've got, you know, the football coach is the history teacher, and, you know, their separation of duties just kind of gets muddled in there anyway. And so now all of a sudden we're expecting this person to take on this additional role. And like you said, they're just not necessarily capable. I mean, time-wise, skill set, like,
yeah,
demeanor, maybe, that, you know, everything.
Demeanor is so important too, right? And the law is not coming with dollars, right? So these schools vary widely in resources. And so some schools, and I know this, I firmly believe some schools are doing the best they can with what they've got. They're trying very, very hard to get this right. Some schools have not tried hard to get this right and are only posting all of this information online as part of a settlement, right? So, like, I don't know why we have to learn things the hard way, but that's definitely out there. And that overlap of positions is just ripe for conflict of interest, right? And that's where this is not working out smoothly for a lot of people. Also, smaller communities, when you know the person as the coach or as the history teacher, or I'm in the history class and it's one of his players, but I want a good grade. I mean, there's just so many ways this could go, which would make it really hard for a person to come forward and avail themselves of the rights and support that Time of Mind has to offer. So I firmly believe we are in the process of sorting this out. Like many laws, it had very, very good intentions. We decide what it applies to. Frankly, in my opinion, people far removed from those implementing it, you know, up close and personal, are giving instruction. And even in the best of intentions, Title IX is tough to implement. I don't know anyone who would say otherwise.
Yeah.
So, Kara, one of the things that you had said, mentioned a little bit ago now, was the Title IX office is often conflated with sexual misconduct. So while sexual misconduct is something that the Title IX office would cover, that's not the only thing that the Title IX office would cover, correct?
Correct. And I think also, to just further complicate that, people also think very narrowly as sexual misconduct is sexual assault. So part of the education that we do, again, I'm on the college campus, but this could apply to all types of institutions, is helping them understand the range of functions and the different things that are covered under Title IX. So it is about equity. It is a law focused on gender equity. And that has meant different things under the past two presidential administrations, and we're getting a signal for a change. So it depends on how you define sex. And that's kind of what the partisan fight is over. How do we define sex in Title IX? How is it defined currently under the regulations that we have, which are still the ones that came up in 2020 under Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos? But Biden has already started the rulemaking process to revise those. So we got a draft, we got notice, we have just closed the comment period. What comes next from the federal government would be review of those comments. And there were over 235,000, and that's a lot in this type of governmental process. And then finalization. So we're gonna be living with the current laws we have for a while, which were narrower on who was covered under that, even though we've seen, I'm really lawyering now, but we've seen like the judges in different districts navigate this. What many people find encouraging is that Biden's Department of Education has already signaled early on that they intend Title IX as is and in the future to cover LGBTQIA+ students, sexual orientation, gender identity, strengthen the right of pregnant students and parents. So it's not just pregnancy, but it's also parenting, right? So we've gotten a signal that, like, if you're lactating and you need to lactate on campus, you need to have a suitable space for that. That's something that's going to come in the final rule that we get under Biden. So if you look at the history, you have like Title IX passing as a law in 72, really coming off of women's movement, civil rights movement, activism about, that was so much focused on admissions, right? So we'd had some women, we had some cool women like Bernice Sandler and Edith Green, Patsy Mink, who the law is now named after, and then Birch Bayh, who was married to a woman who really schooled him on this. Those are his words, not just me giving credit where credit is due. He has given many, many talks where he said, this never occurred to me until, my wife Marvella sat him down and talked about how she was denied a lot of opportunities along the way. So it starts with admissions, then we have a phase where it's really applied to athletics and athletic participation, but it's not just locker rooms, right? It's also other academic facilities and gender equity there. So you could look at women's residence halls versus men's, right, throughout history, or things allocated to the nursing school or programs that are dominated by women. So it gives us the room, even though I would say until very recently, it's focusing on the gender binary. So it's focusing on comparing women and men. It gives us the room to evaluate resources in the educational environment in terms of gender equity. That's what the original law gives us. It's gotten more specific, as laws do, because we apply them to things. There are clarifications, there are guidance documents, there are lawsuits, which give us more and more specifics about what is and is not under Title IX and how to navigate that. So it's gotten more complex, but that can be a really good thing in that it can be really inclusive and that it can apply to more things and more people and strengthen and broaden protections. So that's the promise, I think, of legislation that's in flux.
Yeah, the main purpose of Title IX, essentially, with the way that I describe it now to people, is it's there specifically to make sure that people are able to obtain the education and stuff that they want without interference from an outside source at that college campus in that middle or high school because of what their gender identity or their sexual orientation is.
Right. Right. I keep saying equity law, but like what that means is it's a law designed to protect from discrimination, to protect against discrimination. It is an anti-discrimination law. I'm not sure exactly why it sometimes gets thought of something so different or isolated over here from other forms of discrimination, but it is absolutely part of those amendments, right? And part of that plan. And so there are parts of it that look very much like the Civil Rights Act. There's parts of it that look very much like the ADA, where we talk about what are reasonable accommodations and religious accommodations. And so it's very similar to other types of anti-discrimination law. But I think because recently it's been so directly linked to navigating sexual misconduct that people think of it as somewhat of a different animal when it's actually well established in history and very, very useful. I mean, you should be free from gender discrimination on campus. It is disruptive. And how it gets into sexual misconduct, I'm just going to elaborate on that a minute, because I get that question a lot. People are like, well, why are schools in the business of responding to sexual assault? It just seems so far afield from their area of expertise. And a lot of parents are like, shouldn't we leave this to law enforcement? And for me, for Kara, the human, that answer is definitely no. We ask people to come into our educational environment, whether they're employees or students, right? We're asking them to be here, to come here. Sometimes we're asking them to live here. We owe those people then a duty of care. It's just like a landlord can't have wildly unsafe practices, right? There are laws preventing that. Hotels the same, right? I mean, we're asking people to come into a space. There are lots of employment laws. So here, this is no different. We owe a duty of care to the people that we are hiring, recruiting, admitting, housing, employing, asking to come and visit us. I mean, fans who attend games. I mean, we're asking so many people to come in and out of these spaces, and there's absolutely a duty of care there. So we can't be indifferent to crime or other harmful behaviors on campus. But absolutely, when we're saying to some students on some residential campuses, you must live here. Then when that sexual assault happens here, we can't be like, oh, not ours, you know, good luck to you, right? And act like there's not some connection. And when it's happening at the levels that it is happening, I mean, you cannot disregard this, right? It is unfortunately so common in the college experience that we should be confronting this. This should be part of their education. This should be part of their safety, you know, and protection. And if we have this educational mission that says we're putting responsible citizens out in the world, we should be teaching them not to perpetrate these behaviors when they move on. You can tell where I'm coming from because I'm passionate about this, but I don't see how we could put this in a box and pretend it's not impacting campus. That's just on the student front. Now, all of these academic institutions at every level are employers. And so we absolutely have sexual harassment, sexism, gender discrimination, and stalking, dating violence, domestic violence, sexual exploitation, sexual assault. These things happen where people are, and people are in the workplace, and people are in schools. So I've never understood that either. And Title IX is very much like Title VII. I'll just pause there before I totally nerd out. But like Title VII is a very, very strong employment law. And so I just don't understand that either. It's like, why would we address all the other forms of discrimination and then say, well, this is the one that's just too hot to handle? I'm sure because it's complex and emotionally heavy, that plenty of people would love to not have responsibility for this, but we should be in this, and I'm glad that we are.
And I just want to make one thing clear to anyone listening to our audience. We're not saying that these schools exclude law enforcement from any of this. They just don't push it off and say, okay, your problem, now you deal with it. They're wanting to be an active part of the solution, an active part of the process. So it's not like you report Title IX and we just never talk to law enforcement about it.
Right. Thank you. No, that's very important. It's really not either or. And so, you know, if there are advocates on campus, they are going, or in the community, who regularly work with different academic institutions, they very most likely are going to say, here are your reporting options. Here are your support options. Victim advocacy is really functioning from an empowerment model. We really want to preserve the agency of the person most directly harmed. Sometimes it's tricky with minors. The parents want to do things. Well, sometimes it's difficult with survivors of all ages, frankly, as the parents sometimes have impressions of what they think would be most helpful. But yes, there are plenty of times we work with law enforcement, and law enforcement can be a great community partner in addressing these behaviors. Title IX is just a separate law that tells schools you have to address this anyway, whether or not you have a police department, and that this, like sexual harassment, which is where we get into the civil rights law terminology, which I'm making an umbrella because it's like an umbrella term that all of these behaviors can fall under. It constitutes sexual harassment under the law Title IX. Some of these behaviors may also constitute criminal behaviors depending on the jurisdiction in which you live. And typically, yes, because most jurisdictions address sexual assault, sexual battery, stalking. I said sexual exploitation earlier. That can be defined differently, but where we see non-consensual taking or distribution of photos and videos, some old-fashioned peeping Tom behavior, those illegal invasions of privacy of a sexual nature, absolutely, criminal law can give you tools to address those too. So yes, it's a yes and situation.
And what I would also point out too here is that some of the things that Title IX does cover may not be technically illegal. So like, yeah. I can't call the police and say, hey man, I keep getting these sexual comments about myself, like from people. Like they're like, okay, and is this like a stalking thing? Like there's parts of this that law enforcement really doesn't have a whole lot of legal backing to be able to help with, but the Title IX office does have that ability to help.
Yes, that's very true. So the like that's one of the things I like is when I'm talking with students, I'm saying, well, I don't know what class or TV show they saw that they're coming off of, you know, where they like think they know all there is to know. And I'm like, well, I have really good news for you, though. It's like we're really in a Venn diagram. And that there are some things that the school can do. And this varies by public versus private institution somewhat too. People should just know that. So you would want to look up your school specific policy, procedures, resources, talk to people in the know, try to figure out who that Title IX coordinator is. If you can't find it, let me know. We will figure out who to call. But it does vary from institution. However, Title IX being a civil rights law does address things that wouldn't rise to the level of criminal behavior. So we can address some of the harassing, harmful behaviors before they might turn into, like, escalate into stalking. So you don't have to wait to be harmed in a certain way before you come forward to a school, because they are required to offer you supportive measures. That is said over and over and over in the latest iteration of the law, the 2021, which is the school is required to offer supportive measures. So that's great. We want this, like, remedying the effects of discrimination will require offering some sort of supportive measure. And that is outside of, or regardless, a student choosing to go through a formal investigation or formal complaint process. And that's great. That's how the law should be. Come forward for support, choose whether or not formal action and investigation, you know, is right for you. But we want to help you as soon as we can, right? We want to stop the harmful behaviors and support the person. And so that I really like about the messaging that is and has been in Title IX.
So in some of these Title IX laws and some of the coordinator responsibilities, they have the power to try and address some of the conduct and culture of that institution, whereas a law enforcement agency can't come in and say, oh, you guys are being rude. Like,
no.
But if we want our institutions to have, you know, this inclusive environment, those Title IX coordinators can help facilitate that type of environment.
Yes. So if you think of a lot of the dialogue about addressing microaggressions or bystander intervention, which I'm like, yes, let's just intervene in lots of places, right? Like, don't wait for your most heroic or the most tragic, horrific thing, right? We want you to intervene early and often. That's going to be a whole range of behaviors, if there's a spectrum, that may not violate an institution's sexual misconduct policy, yet the office or the school has some tools that they can offer you before it meets a definition of harm. So we would love for people to come forward sooner for support, to talk through what's happening, hopefully be able to connect with a prevention educator or victim advocate, because those people do tend to really focus on a specific way of offering safety planning. And not necessarily wait until we're addressing a policy violation, but hopefully we are disrupting and de-escalating situations. And a lot of people actually are trying to resolve it without a formal process. And so, yeah, let's help them do that, right? The way in which they're ready to do it, the way in which that feels really productive and conducive for them.
So in there, you mentioned the seeking out services, getting help and stuff, but also that formal process or that formal complaint. So could you really quickly just kind of explain to our audience what that difference might be? Just so in case somebody is listening and they're like, oh, maybe I do want to use my Title IX office. What can they expect from that?
Okay. So this varies actually between K-12 and college and university. Okay. And I'm much more experienced in the college and university setting. So on the college or university setting, a person typically has options, and it's great that they have options. So on many campuses, they will have a policy. It should be available on the web. It should be distributed to all students and employees in a number of ways. And it's probably going to be long. That's going to be a lengthy, highly legalistic document, would be my guess. Some schools have infographics and flowcharts. So I do think, you know, doing some research, browsing around the Title IX office's page is worth doing. So there could be also some differences between public and private institutions in their process. And a person should just know that, right? So listeners should just know that. But in general, what you will then see is the opportunity to file a formal complaint. And so a person can, in the exercise of their rights, come forward and say formally, which often means in writing, but they might be able to take it, take the information in a variety of ways. It would be trauma-informed. I welcome, you know, whatever, I welcome collecting information, whatever way feels the easiest or most doable for the target or the survivor of the alleged misconduct. So you collect that information, you can say, yes, I think this was wrong. I think this is a policy violation. I would like it investigated. I would like this person subject to sanctions under the school policy. So that formal process is typically called an investigation. I pretty consistently, but it is where people who are labeled as investigators or charged with the responsibility of investigating will typically start with the person who's come forward. And that could be a witness, that could be a third party, that could be the target of the bad behavior or the victim or survivor in the situation, right? So it starts with them, collects the information. That's the human you have in front of you. This makes really logical sense. You know, you start with the person who's willing to provide you with information. The investigator will have to ask tough questions. I mean, it is about an incident. It is about a harm. It is about a boundary violation or some trauma. So people should know going in that this could be a tough conversation, and it could be a long conversation. Now, I always like to remind people that you control the information you share, and it doesn't always feel like that. And sometimes when you're getting questioned by someone older than you or an authority figure, that's hard to remember. I love when advocates accompany people because that's their job to like kind of make sure that we're taking care of the person there, check in, do you want to take a break, reinforce that sense of agency. And so I like people to, you know, I would urge people to do your research first, schedule the appointment if you're going in to talk to the office on a time that's really convenient for you. Doesn't have to be convenient for them. You know, this is their job. At a time that's convenient for you, where you feel most able to do this, and know that you can stop at any time. Okay, so you don't have to keep telling your story. If you decide you want to quit in the process, you can quit in the process. But it may take a couple of meetings to fully tell your story, and they may have follow-up questions, and that's a normal investigation, even though it doesn't feel very good really to the person who's being asked about what could be a really devastating and harmful traumatic experience of their life. The investigation might ask people to provide text messages or pictures or videos or names of witnesses. What sometimes is painful for students is when they've named a friend as a witness and that person declines to go in, right? So you should know that it depends on the school policy, but everyone you name as a witness may not choose to say what you want them to say when they go in. Some cases have no witnesses called, some have 20. You know, I think the possibilities are endless there. It will vary by situation to situation. The more people involved, the longer the cases do tend to take for the investigation to be thorough. At some point, when they've collected at least, you know, enough to have an understanding of the incident, the office is going to evaluate, you know, the information collected from one perspective, which is, if I take this to be true, is there a policy violation, right? And if so, then it will likely move forward. The institution does have some room under the current regulations to dismiss complaints. And so people should know that just because you come forward does not mean the university is going to investigate as thoroughly as you might like. And that can be very painful. Now it's very difficult though for a school to be told detailed information and decide early on that they don't want to proceed with an investigation and not face some liability for that. So depending on the framework, the motivations, orientation of the people doing the work at the school, you know, in the college and university setting, remember, we're more years into this intense period, I see more of a willingness to open investigations than I am currently seeing in K through 12. I think we'll see that change. The colleges and universities do seem primed to assume it's going to move forward, assume they're going to collect more information, and then that at that point, they will provide notice to the accused. So the person who's accused of violating the policy in some way, in Title IX land, it doesn't mean you're accused of violating criminal law. They may also be facing criminal charges, but these are separate processes that can run simultaneously. Sometimes Title IX starts and then a criminal one will pick up, and Title IX might pause because we don't want to interfere with criminal investigations, but you can't pause indefinitely, right? So they could be running simultaneously, but the thing to remember is these are separate, right? And they give a survivor separate rights. But under Title IX, we would notify the person that they, the institution has received some information that they may have violated the policy, invite them to come in, speak with the investigator. Whether or not a student is compelled to participate, I think varies by school. You know, at many institutions, their participation is voluntary, so they don't necessarily have to come forward and participate in an investigation, but there's a motivation to do so because they'll want to share their side of the story. The school will typically make a decision based on the information they have. And so we do see a lot of accused students participate and come forward and give their side of the story. And that side of the story is typically why they believe they did not violate the policy. They too can provide evidence like pictures, videos, text messages, really anything they think is relevant. They too can name witnesses. Both parties can have an advisor of their choosing. At different institutions, the investigators may share information with the students at different points, but it should be equitable. So they should be getting the same information around the same time. So for example, if there's a preliminary report that would be sent out to both the complainant and respondent, those are the terms we use. So the complainant is the person filing the complaint. Often that is the target survivor, right? And the respondent is responding to the complaint, so that the person has been accused. So you're going to see in a lot of policies now us using legal terminology like complainant and respondent, which is concerning because it's not so student friendly or parent friendly, but that is where we've landed in this increasingly legalistic compliance landscape. And so at this point, you should see in policies and procedures equity coming back in, which is they get this information at the same time. They both have an opportunity to respond to it. If there's a preliminary report involved, that's also an opportunity to be like, hey, I think you need to ask more questions. Hey, I want to respond to what they said about this part right here. Oh, I didn't know they were going to talk about that, but I have a really good witness for this over here. And then that could be compiled or combined into a final report under a policy, which then is sent to a decision maker. This is just really complicated. So the 2020 regulations were for a period of time requiring live hearings. So at that point, the investigators would have a report, but then a live hearing, which is like a hearing that people are imagining, is happening where cross-examination was happening. Now that absolutely was scary to a lot of students. I mean, it was. Mm-hmm. So we heard before the passage of that, many voices saying this is not necessary. You know, fairness is built into the process, lots of opportunities to be heard, kind of like I was just describing, opportunities to know the charges against you, provide evidence, provide witnesses, have an advisor of your choosing, which includes a lawyer, you know, and move forward. For a lot of people, meant the cross-examination wasn't necessary. But the more you think of this as a criminal process, the more some people were believing cross-examination was necessary. It has a strong legal tradition of helping, you know, reveal the truth is the mindset there. Now, we didn't have that very long without interruption. So some judges were striking that down in different districts. And then the Biden administration signaled that the live hearing was no longer required. Some schools can still choose to use it. sorry, this has gotten so complex, but it's just, we do have variation in different school districts and at different institutions. So there may or may not be a hearing, and that would be something really important to know going into the process. What I've seen happen is people file a formal complaint, participate in the investigation when it is this private meeting with one or two employees that feels doable. I've seen a lot of people withdraw their complaint before the hearing. Some people are going through with the hearing. Many schools were doing it on Zoom or other online, you know, video platform, which can be helpful because you don't have to sit necessarily in the same room with the person, you know, who they've come forward and said has harmed them. But it did have to be live, and it have to be like cameras on, you know, so that was really traumatizing for the people who've gone through that. Now, there seemed like there was a collective sigh of relief when we were told we didn't have to do the hearings, and many schools have chosen to abandon that pretty quickly, but it's not forbidden. And so the signal we've gotten, I think, from the proposed changes is that that will no longer be a part of the process, and we'll return to what was a very typical student conduct-like process that doesn't require that in the future, but we just don't know yet. So it could go to a hearing with a person who, it's an adjudicator, but they are like a judge, you know, who would ask questions, would govern, you know, but you could get questioned by a defense attorney. Like, attorneys are increasingly involved in these. And so that's very, very intimidating. But you do have the right to pose questions to each other. And so that could then go to a decision maker. It's not a jury. Okay, so the school would designate who's going to be the decision maker in this situation, who would then determine if the policy were violated, and then would look to the policy to see what an appropriate sanction would be. Now, many schools have pretty steep sanctions, especially if it's sexual assault, like a contact or penetration-based offense, of suspension or expulsion. But that's an important thing to remember too, and then I will wrap up this very long answer, which is that the reason this is not criminal law or a criminal process is there's only so many things a school can do to you. A school can say, you can't go to school here. A school can say, you can no longer work here. But the school under Title IX is not putting anyone in prison, right? So that's also a reason. There's a difference, and that's a reason that the evidentiary standard is lower and considered appropriate.
No, thank you for that very much in-depth discussion on what that process might look like, because we know that one of the barriers that many people can face when trying to go through with doing something is not knowing what that's going to look like. Like, I know for even myself, like, if I don't know how to do something, like, that's, I'm not going to do it. Like, I don't want to run the risk of going wrong.
Right. Too intimidating. Yeah,
exactly. And I just want to make sure that I add in here then for some people listening that while yes, suspension and expulsion from the school can be a thing that could be the result of the Title IX process, the other results could be making that person have to change their school schedule, making that person have to have different living situations, like maybe they'd be moved to a different dorm. So they're not necessarily saying that if somebody is going through this Title IX process, the ultimate outcome of that is going to be that person will be removed from the school forever. But there will be things put in place to make sure that the victim in this situation has the most ease of access to their educational opportunities.
Yes, that's correct. I mean, some of those are supportive measures that don't require like a hearing or an investigation. And that's what I love. That's what I love about Title IX. It's like if there are two class sections and you'd be more comfortable switching classes to not be in the class with your, you know, perpetrator, let's switch classes, right? That's easy enough to do. Without some sort of hearing or investigation, the school's unlikely to inconvenience the accused student, but we can very proactively support the victim survivor in many ways when it's not the equity question, right? So we wouldn't necessarily kick an accused out of a class and say the other person can stay there, but we will see how we can maneuver it, right? Like, do they need to live in the same dorm? Not necessarily, right? So we can change housing, we can change parking, we can change some on-campus work assignments, we can change class schedules, you know, class sections. Sometimes we can communicate with the faculty member to be like, please don't put these people on group work, you know, like, so what I love is being able to have a really individualized plan for the victim survivor about like, what makes this feel doable for you? Like, how can we make you feel safe on campus? How can we make you feel like you can fully participate? And there's a lot of room for that. The 2020 regulations also gave schools the option of offering informal resolution, and that can look many, many different ways, but that's another way for the, I keep saying target or survivor or the victim to come forward and have agency and say, you know, I don't need the full process, but there are some things I want. And I've seen through those people be able to read a victim impact statement because they just wanted to be heard. They wanted the other person to understand what has happened to them, to ask for some consent or other healthy relationships education for the accused, to kind of negotiate who's going to participate in what student organization. The potential of informal resolution is great. And there's a lot of desire on college campuses for us to incorporate restorative or transformative justice process, like procedures, into that aspect of what Title IX is currently offering us.
So mentioning in there some of the things that can be done for just kind of doing that confidential report or not going through the full process, what are some of those things? So we mentioned like maybe kind of moving their schedule around, maybe doing different work hours and stuff on campus, but is there anything else that would be included in that that might be beneficial to somebody who is not really wanting to go through that formal process?
Yes. So another thing that would be useful to know about if the school offers them, which I know a lot do, I don't know that all do. We call them no contact directives. They're also sometimes called stay away orders, although stay away order would imply a geographical distancing component to it, whereas no contact does allow for them to be in the same class, for example, or to eat in the same dining hall. But those are useful tools on their own. Those are useful tools after a person's come forward. We would use them without requiring the full story because we use them as a keep the peace measure where we're saying nobody's in trouble. We, you know, we're not pursuing a hearing, but these two students just need to not have contact with one another, right? Like let's de-escalate the situation. And that's expansive in that we mean like not LinkedIn, not Instagram, not all the things, not indirectly, not through your friends, not verbally face-to-face, right? Not through your online course management system. Because sometimes people try to find a workaround. That's why I'm kind of like, what else could they do? LinkedIn is usually the last resort for our college students, but even there, not smoke signal. You know, I'm always like trying to think of all the different, not a carrier pigeon. and that really does diffuse a lot of situations. And so that can be really useful. So I think it's just important for the listener to know that there's probably many more options than you know about, right? So if you're thinking the hearing's the only option or something high stakes, or that a criminal trial is required, where we're really moving the needle on the issue and addressing a lot of behavior in ways that allow for re-education and rehabilitation are all those things in between, right? Are all the things in between. Because when we make it high stakes, like you have to choose whether or not someone is facing expulsion from the university, a lot of people are going to choose not to come forward. The confidential report can be useful. And so there's probably different ways to come forward on a campus. If you have confidential resources, you can absolutely avail yourself of those. Those tend to be the counseling center, university chaplains, medical providers, right? They can provide confidentiality that doesn't tend to result in notification to anyone else, right? Notification of the Title IX coordinator. Now, listen, there are always exceptions. So, you know, I'm trained as a lawyer. I just can't not. There are always exceptions. So threat of harm to self or others and things like that could trigger exceptions. But those are like, I want to talk to someone and keep it confidential. Then there are a lot of resources that are private that may have to tell someone on a very limited need to know basis. So it's just good to know that before you choose a support resource, because you don't want to lose control of what's happening to you. People don't want to get caught in a process they didn't choose to participate in. So take that to just do some internet searching, not a don't come forward because there are lots of resources, and colleges and universities are in a phase of dramatically expanding all their health and well-being resources. And that's a much needed phase of growth for us, but they will vary. So some of the benefits though, from creating anonymous or confidential reporting options is that they're giving us details and sometimes names that are enabling those of us charged with keeping campus safe to connect some dots and address some serial perpetration behaviors. So if you're thinking at home, like, I wish the school knew this, even though I don't want them to do that, your victim advocates, you know, your counseling office, those might be the resources that know how to navigate your process, whatever that is, in those ways, right? So if people just really want us to know that this thing is happening over here, I want to know that. I want to know that. I mean, think of these like heartbreaking scandals with hundreds of victims that just pop up in the news far too often. I want us to be well-equipped to disrupt that behavior as quickly as possible. And a system that relies solely on a person who's been harmed to file a formal complaint is not one that's equipped to address those early and often, right? That's too high stakes. That's asking so much of a person who's already been harmed. So I'm all for a variety of options. I'll take the information in snippets and incomplete paragraphs and a bulleted list, you know, however anyone wants to give it. To whoever they want to give it to on campus. That's the phase I'm in, where it's like, we really should be making it as easy as possible for people to tell us things they think we need to know.
So, you know, even if this doesn't get to the formal complaint or these even informal sanctions and things like that, that go on, at least it's on someone's radar. You know, there's someone that can be kind of looking out for that. If, you know, you think of, you know, all of these athletes who have been victimized by, you know, a coach or a medical athletic director, whatever, if that had been on someone's radar earlier on, might some of those have been able to be stopped?
Right. Yeah. Right. That's the goal. That's the rationale behind this push to really expand the list of who's a mandatory reporter in the educational environment. Now this is part of a current debate, like, has the proposed regulations gone too far? So you could see that if you start to dig in on this issue. But it is a response really to those types of incidents that's saying, we're not going to be unclear about this. Certain people and a number of people in the educational environment should have responsibility, because we've seen what happens when it's left up to the institution to define mandatory reporting, and when it's too small a list, you know. Now, it doesn't need to, I don't want the institution to be like, let's just make it everybody, you know, which is sometimes the temptation. It's like, if we just say everybody is, then problem solved. You want to give survivors options, right? Just making everyone a mandatory reporter does not immediately change your campus environment. That does not make it inclusive. That does not make it safe. You know, that has some gifts like making the list and the policy clearer, but that's not creating the conditions that are going to reduce the perpetration of these harms and behaviors or make people really feel supported. So this is something where we, you know, to get it right, you do have to put in the work and you do have to think through the different types of categories of employers on your campus. Because some people do need that very strict, like, rulemaking, like, you're a mandatory reporter, no messing around, no pretending like you don't know what you do know. But other people are serving a really much needed function of a safe space to land and get information and explore options. And so I want that to continue to exist for those people who are most likely to be impacted by this type of discrimination, harm, or violence.
Yeah. And I'm glad the mandatory reporter thing came up, because that was one of the points I wanted to make before I threw my final question at you, Kara, is with the mandated reporting, specifically looking at the K through 12 situation, a lot of educational staff that are going to be in those schools are mandated reporters. So some of the things that Title IX does cover then may trigger that mandated reporter to have to actually report it. So that might just be something you want to keep in mind if you happened to be somebody listening in middle school or high school who is looking at potentially reporting this or trying to go through the Title IX process, is that those who you will be working with are more often than not going to be that mandated reporter. So once you've given that information to them, that's going to get the ball rolling, and it might get the ball rolling in a direction that you don't necessarily want the ball to go.
That's a real risk, right? And that's the balancing act, because it's everyone feels very strongly that we have a duty to protect the most vulnerable, and minors are deemed more vulnerable. And minors tend to be who's in the K through 12 environment, but this also applies, you know, in colleges and universities, especially if they're admitting 15, 16, 17 year olds, right? Where we see some of that happening, or a lot of 17 year olds coming in. And so that is going to vary by your state, right? That's going to vary by jurisdiction as to what's the extent of that reporting obligation. Is it just that the employee has to report to the unit, the institution's Title IX coordinator, or do they also have to report to, you know, your Department of Child Services or whoever it might be? So I say that not to scare people away from coming forward. It's just why we want you to know about your resources and choose the ones that's most right for you. But also in terms of, I want you to think in terms of assertiveness too. It's like, share what you need to share to get the help that you need, but also know that, like, you don't actually have to tell someone parts that you're not ready to tell yet. You know, like, that's okay too. It is your story to share or not share when you're ready to do so, when it feels safe for you to do so. So if there are things you think people need to know I hear this a lot, like, try to prevent harm to others, consider telling someone that piece, but you don't have to tell things that are going to make you feel too vulnerable, exposed, or unsafe. It's really tricky. It does vary by situation, but I promise you there are some national resources and hotlines that would love to talk through this with you, right? So that no one listening is alone, even when it feels like maybe no one's in your school district where you have that you could turn to.
Yeah. So very quickly then, jumping into just the last thing that I wanted to ask you on for this is, I have heard from people before that the Title IX process for them didn't work, or that when you mentioned earlier that sometimes they may deem something as like, well, we're not going to look into this because it doesn't fall under the cat under what we believe to be gender discrimination or discrimination here. So if that does happen, what are some resources then available that somebody might be able to utilize if the school found or said that what they were reporting was not covered then under Title IX?
I would hope that the school would offer the student all the supportive measures and resources that they would offer if it did. So there's that, right? So we still can make you more comfortable, even if we think there's insufficient evidence or it doesn't meet a definition. You know, like, so I would urge school officials to really remember why you went into the job, right? We are trying to take care of students. We are trying to foster positive environments. So you do have room to offer things even when you're not required to offer them, right? So think of compliance as the floor. Doesn't mean we can't do a lot better than what the law requires. We can, we absolutely can. The law should be the bare minimum. But you also may have a right to appeal that decision. Some of the policies outline that. It's always a good question to ask. Everyone has some boss somewhere, so you can always email the person's boss if there's no policy or form. And that's worth doing. That's worth doing, right? Put it on their radar. Make people defend their work, right? Especially if you feel like this is injustice and you've been wronged. And some people don't understand the extent of the harm and the impact it has. So I sometimes have students who would like to write a victim impact statement, not necessarily to be heard by the offender, but to be heard by the administrator who made a decision that they disagreed with. And if that's going to feel useful to them, that's something that they can do, right? You can write it and send an email, you can write it and deliver it in hard copy, you know, like whatever feels good for you. And we would just brainstorm things like, how can we help you feel like you can take control of your narrative? Some students go talk to a lawyer and evaluate school decisions and process and feel, you know, did the school handle this correctly? And that can be exploratory, or they can file lawsuits. They also can file a complaint, a different type of complaint, with the Department of Education itself. So the Department of Education has an Office of Civil Rights who will investigate whether schools are handling things correctly. There are forms online for that. There's some hotlines that people can call to get some assistance. And that has absolutely been happening. That really drove a lot of the change on college campuses, really from 2010 to probably today, really. Because that gets a lot of attention and you have to answer the Department of Education. And so that can be a way. Now that's a long process. So in the short term, I have students who sometimes turn to activism on campus and want to support other survivors. So there are things like, do you want to join a support group? Do you want to join a student organization who's working on this? Now, it is also totally valid if that feels too hard too soon and you want to take some time. So it just varies by person. So sometimes they want to just set it aside for a while and then come back to some sort of, I say activism, but can take all forms. So you don't have to necessarily be the person out in public saying I'm a survivor and sharing my story. Some people just like to table with us during Sexual Assault Awareness Month and quietly hand out stickers and pens, and that's fine too. So it's really what would make you feel better about the aftermath of an incident, the aftermath of the Title IX process. There are people who want to help you cope and heal and be resilient and thrive, right? And look for them and hang out with them and talk to them. And, you will make it through. And a lot of people do tell us, right, that the process is really taxing on them and really painful. But it doesn't mean that they can't have a wonderful experience at their college or university or have romantic and sexy and fun relationships, in the aftermath of an incident. They absolutely do. So all of those things are possible.
And I would be remiss if I did not add that you could also just contact a local domestic or sexual violence shelter who provides services as well, because if your college campus is not providing you with the resources that they should be providing you, absolutely should be providing you, reach out to outside resources as well. There's always going to be, hopefully, something in that community that will be able to meet your needs.
And even if those resources are there in the college, you just don't feel comfortable going through those again because, maybe you're claim wasn't investigated and now you don't feel like you can trust those people. Outside resources are there to help you. And then if you decide that you do want to go back and file that formal complaint, or if you decide that you want to have it reevaluated or whatever the case is, you would have an advocate from your local agency to also help stand by your side on that.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Kara, for joining us today for this discussion. It's always nice hearing about Title IX from people who basically use Title IX every day for their job, because it's gonna sound a little different coming from Amanda and I, who just like, yeah, I know what Title IX is, but I don't use this in my day-to-day life. So
yeah. It's complicated, and I, definitely covered some of the complex details. Hopefully it will get streamlined and a little bit easier and student and parent friendly. We'll see. That is my hope. But thanks so much for having me.
Well, anyone listening, don't worry. When changes do happen, we will make sure that we reach out to Kara again to come through and explain all of those lovely details for us. So before we sign off then, Kara, is there anything else that you wanted to add or any socials and stuff that you want to throw out to the audience?
Well, there are some that I'll mention, actually. For K-12, there's a really great resource called Stop Sexual Assault in Schools. So that's ssais.org. And they have a lot of different resources, some videos that might be helpful. So, if I overcomplicated the hearing process, watch these videos by students who are telling you a little bit about what it felt like for them. I would say look for the resources that have whoever your peer is talking to you. I've seen them on TikTok. There are definitely some on YouTube. Like, that will speak to you in your most direct language about what coming forward and going through this might be like. But I promise you, there are people who want to help. You know, my office is full of them. They're in every state. They're in, you know, in every community. Nobody has to suffer alone. People will believe you and want to help you.
Yes. So thank you so much again for joining us, Kara. Those listening also, if you have not checked it out, we did an episode a few months back now with Kara talking all about assertiveness. So check that one out because that one was awesome. And thank you all for listening today. Please feel free to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok at Touchy Subs Pod to keep up to date when we have new episodes coming out or anything else we just like to throw out there. Email us any questions, comments, or concerns to touchysubjectspodcast@gmail.com. And please rate us and follow us on your favorite podcast listening app. It really does help the show out.
And in the meantime, don't be afraid to challenge, ask, and discuss when it comes to touchy subjects.